Dr. Rock's radio show. Thursday 9 p.m. to midnight on peoplesinternetradio.com. We go to 11.
Well, good evening one and all, and a very warm welcome to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. Welcome to all you people in the chat box. Big congratulations to the admin team for getting us back on air and getting it all working properly after the last 7 days or so of difficulties. Thanks very much to Nick Nomick as well for another great show before Dr. Rock. We kicked off there with AC/DC, Shot Down in Flames, which is broadly speaking what we need to do to the system that we find ourselves existing in at the moment. Followed by Mott the Hoople, good old piece of analog production now. Wonder if you could hear the difference all the way from Memphis. Faithless, God is a DJ, although of course tonight it's me, you'll have to put up with that. And finishing off there, the opening tunes with the Buffalo Skinners and Lose My Soul, which is what's certainly going to happen if we don't start taking some action. And I'm very pleased and excited tonight to be joined by Dave Darby from the Low Impact Living Initiative, whose website can be found at www.lowimpact.org. And welcome, Dave, to People's Internet Radio. Thanks very, very much for making the time to join us on the show. It's very good of you.
Hello, Dr. Rock. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, I'm looking forward to a lively and varied discussion. I'd like to kick off by congratulating you on your excellent website, which has been keeping me really entertained for the last few days. It's very clear, very informative, really easy to navigate, and absolutely full of resource. Is that all your own work, or have you got a kind of team of people helping you out?
There's a team of people, yeah. We've taken on people to look after different sections of the website. There's always been a gang of us. Some people have come and gone. And we've got a network of specialists in all of our topics all over the country, so we're able to interview people and harvest information from them.
And how long's the radio been running? The website.
Oh, the website. Yeah. Or the radio. Yeah. We're the website. Since 2001, there weren't very many people doing that kind of thing back in 2001. But I'm glad to say there are lots of people doing it now.
Yeah, I guess you've seen a lot of change in that time.
Yeah. It's a wonderful thing, the internet.
Certainly is. And are you finding your list of contributors and informed people is still growing?
Yeah, I mean, we've just started to make it into we got a new website this year, and we've started making it into a proper official network with a directory, and there's a fee to be in the directory, but if we really like what you're doing, we'll put you in for free anyway, and if you put the network logo on your website, and so we're building up a big bank of wonderful people.
Which is, I think, exactly what we need to be doing at this sort of point, isn't it, really? We need to be talking to each other and taking advantage of each other's skills now that we've got access to them.
Exactly, yeah.
So your caption at the top says, let's build a sustainable non-corporate system, which I think is good and punchy as well. Presumably you meaning the real sustainable, where the systems we're running sustain the people and sustain the planet.
Yeah, well, we started off as an environmental organisation. We've always been an environmental organisation. Our angle is ecology. And I think the majority of people now understand that what's happening to ecology is not just unfortunate. It could be catastrophic. And peer-reviewed ecologists are telling us in no uncertain terms that unless we change direction, we're headed for ecological collapse. And there's something called the cascade point, and they're talking about us reaching a cascade point where the mass extinction event that we find ourselves in at the moment just runs away with itself, and we hemorrhage species until we're headed for a desert planet, really. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you watched your David Attenborough programs when you were a kid, but it became very clear to me that nature is a web of lots of interconnected species in ways, most of which we don't even understand yet. But if you take too many species out of that network, then it starts to fall over. And, we've had an economic crash. An ecological crash would be, would be something completely different and possibly fatal to humans. I can't see any way that we could survive it, really. If we hit that cascade point and it started to fall away from us, I don't think there's much we can do.
And, of course, we wouldn't really know when that cascade point occurs, would we?
We wouldn't know when the point occurs, but when things start to go and start to slip. I mean, there are different theories about what exactly happened on Easter Island, but it wasn't exactly a thriving community when the Europeans got there.
It was damn sight less thriving once the Europeans arrived, wasn't it? I think
once they did arrive, yeah. But I think a lot of people get the ecological message now, and I've certainly never met anybody calling themselves an environmentalist who didn't get that. But I think we really need to change direction, and that's where people on the environmental side of things sometimes miss something really important, and it's the fact that actually we live in a completely corporate dominated economy and system. It's not an exaggeration to call it an empire, and a lot of people don't get that. So I wanted to put that front and center right on the homepage of the website, that actually we can't have a sustainable system if we can't tweak corporate capitalism. It's not tweakable. It has elements that force it to grow and force wealth to concentrate in fewer and fewer hands. And so we really have to start talking about how we change it, what a new system might look like, and how we might get there.
Yeah, and the corporate system does concentrate on growth almost entirely, doesn't it? It takes no account of the fact that things need to breathe in and breathe out. You can't have something that's growing all the time, because ultimately it will just be to a massive cost.
Well, this seems obvious when you have a conversation with somebody like you. It seems like the most obvious thing in the world. But it's, and I've tried to have this conversation with people, and I've found that the best way to get it across is a very simple way. It's a 4-point thing. The first point is, you can't have material growth forever. We can't have more fridges, more cars, more roads, more houses every year forever. That's ludicrous. We can't have constant material growth. And I think everybody gets that. But economic growth means that there's a growth in spending power. If there's not a growth in spending power, then it's not economic growth. It's something like a devaluation of the currency or something. But economic growth will always result in an increase in spending power. Now, once you've got that increase in spending power, there's absolutely no way to ring fence it so that it's not spent on material things. So therefore, if the economy continues to grow forever and spending power continues to grow forever, then material growth is going to happen. You can't stop it. You can't ring fence it around non-material things. And therefore, it's just a logical conclusion that we can't have perpetual growth. It's totally impossible.
And I suppose that's where the low impact part comes in, doesn't it, really? Because it's suggesting that what we might want to do is downsize and spend less, and you know, we can do more, but we just want less. We want fewer things.
Yeah. I mean, that's a bit difficult for some people to hear, I suppose, these days, in terms of austerity, when some people have got very little, and especially in developing countries, they have almost nothing. So that's not a message for probably most of the people in the world. But the problem is that the consumption and wealth and power is being concentrated in very, very few hands, and there's a lot of it. We live in most people in the West live in relative luxury compared to people in developing countries who, you know, their only option is sweatshops or plantations, no unions, no health and safety, no unemployment benefit, no sickness benefit. No retirement pensions, no safety net at all.
There's a sign that we're heading that way here, slowly but surely, at least those of us that are down at the bottom of the ladder.
It could be, yeah, for quite a lot of people, yeah.
And also, of course, it's the way the West has kind of grown, because when I think about this sort of conversation about fewer things and less spending power, we realise that, you know, a few years back, hotels would have had rooms, and a number of rooms would have shared a bathroom, but then it eventually got to the point where every room is, as they say, en suite, so every room's got a bathroom, every kitchen's got a fire blanket, but hardly any of those fire blankets are ever going to be used. They're just manufactured and sold, presumably they have a kind of they have a use by date and have to be replaced, and we are actually generating a whole lot of demand for things that either aren't necessary or that we're never going to use, and that of course is also at the cost of the people in the other third of the world, or whatever it is, two-thirds of the world.
Yeah, we do have a massive multi-billion dollar advertising industry trying to persuade us to buy things that we never thought we needed.
Yeah, whereas if you really do need it and you really do want it, it doesn't need to be advertised.
Yeah.
So it was I know it says on the website in your light bulb moments blog that it was really the extinction thing and the endangered animals that first drew your attention to this. I suppose you were probably quite a young man when that occurred, were you?
Yeah, I was a kid. I was watching the David Attenborough programs, and they all finished the same way. You know, by the way, all these animals you've been watching are on the verge of extinction, and I got that there was something seriously wrong when I was a kid. I didn't really know what it was, I forget how old I was exactly. I was around about 20 when the Ethiopian famine happened, and I remember looking into it because I discovered that Ethiopia was exporting food all the way through the famine, and that just blew me away. I couldn't quite understand why a country with 11 million people starving to death was exporting food. But then, of course, I discovered that it was land owned by multinational corporations, and they were growing luxury crops, really, for the West, tea and coffee and tin pineapples. And that was another penny that dropped. And there's no global food shortage.
No, indeed, and I suspect that's a comment that can get you into quite a lot of trouble with quite a lot of people. But
that's absolutely every continent has a food surplus, and obviously the problem in the West is not enough food. The problem is obesity and lots of illnesses related to eating too much, really. And close to half the food produced for the Western market is wasted. Either it's just not eaten, or it goes bad before it's even cooked, or it goes past its sell by date and it's wasted. There's no food shortage. There's a systemic problem, and there's a money shortage for some people. People who can't afford to eat properly don't have the money. If they did have the money, they would be able to eat properly. There's no food shortage as such.
And don't have access to land either. I think that's because if you don't have access to land, then the problem of not having access to money becomes that much more serious.
Yeah. And this is why you have people like the corporate environmentalists, Mark Lynas and his ilk, who are pushing GM, and they also push the Green Revolution as a way of increasing the food supply. But that's the wrong. That particular solution doesn't have a problem that it solves, because there's no food shortage. All it does really is concentrate our the global food industry into the hands of just a very few corporations, and that is the aim of it. That's not a bad side effect. That's the aim of it.
Certainly is, and it seems to have been a practice that's run for some time. It has been it's been a subject that's come up a lot on people's internet radio, is the fact that exactly the same was true for the so-called Irish potato famine, that there was tons and tons and tons of food being exported more or less on the same ships that were being used to export the people from their homeland, the people who were actually carrying the culture of the place. So they were sort of killing several birds with one stone, if you like, in that they were getting a lot of food over to England and probably other places in the world, and they were throwing people out of their homes, exporting people. I believe the same was true of Mao's famine in China, that there was actually no famine, that it simply was if we're going to be crude about it, it was basically population control. It was basically eradication of people. And of course, your GM foods or whatever other technological solutions we might come up to these imagined problems are actually corporate solutions, when what you actually want is people not exporting more food, not exporting all the food. People on the land need some of it to eat, and people need to have access to land to grow it.
Yeah. And the situation is becoming worse now in Asia and Africa. There's a there's a massive corporate land grab going on. So that particular problem is going to be exacerbated.
Yeah, Nick Nomix put in the chat box that Monsanto is effectively creating a food shortage by providing us with seeds that fail and are not going to work in the long term because they're actually not part of the ecology either.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they'll work in the long term. Yeah, I don't know if there's a technical problem with them or whether there's an environmental problem with them. I'm not sure about that. I think the jury's out on that. But there's no need for them. There's no need for them at all. Why risk it? All they're for is to put more and more of our food supply into the hands of fewer and fewer people, the people at the top of the corporate empire.
Yeah, and the result is to reduce the variety of foods and seeds available, which is being worked on very hard at the moment. I can almost see the classic seeds disappearing to the point where it's actually I wouldn't have believed this 20 years ago that people could actually make it illegal to sell or swap or trade various sorts of vegetable seeds. I mean, that in itself to me is an indication, which is, you know, it's in the public domain, and because I do a lot of gardening, as soon as it started happening, it was an alert sign to me. But it does seem to me that the majority of people don't seem to think it's important or strange or anything. I mean, we should be having more and more different varieties of seed as more and more people grow things and sort of, cross-pollinate them and things like that. There's absolutely no need to genetically modify things.
There are some great people doing some wonderful things, though, to fight back and to hang on to these seeds. And, well, in all the different kinds of fields that we operate in, there are just wonderful, wonderful people doing fantastic things. And they do have victories. They definitely have victories. I mean, the multilateral agreement on investments, which was the precursor to TTIP, I don't know when it was, 8 to 10 years ago, though, it was defeated. It was blocked. It was stopped by activists. It's back as TTIP, and I'm not sure whether they're going to be able to stop it this time, but it will come back again. You know, they won't rest until they've sucked up, all the world's economy. These people, they do have little victories, but within this system, it seems to be, you know, one step forward and 1,000 steps back. I think unless we can seriously start discussing how we change this system wholesale, I can hear myself say these words, and in a way, it sounds ridiculous because if I imagine talking to my family or just people you chat to in the pub, but it is a revolution that we need, and I'm not talking violence, but we do need revolutionary change rather than incremental change. Incremental change won't do it. It's not enough. There are some great people doing great things, but ultimately it's not enough. We need systemic change.
We do, and for that, I think we need to cooperate. I can't remember who it was that said that if you want incremental change, compete, but if you want systematic change, you need to cooperate. Are you talking to people in pubs and the family and stuff like that? I'm thinking particularly in the pubs and on the streets. I mean, I'm noticing that more and more people are talking about the things that we've been talking about for years. It does seem that we're moving towards the kind of realizations we need to make these kind of changes, and as you say, people are having victories, they are working together, and there is now, at least now there is a lot of noise about TTIP.
Yeah, I mean, not enough. Still the vast majority of people probably don't understand, they've never heard of it. But I think the good news is that if it doesn't require a majority for systemic change to happen, in fact, It's usually happened with a really, really tiny percentage of the population. And if you think of the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, now I'm not saying that the Russian Revolution was the right idea. It absolutely wasn't. If you take power using violence, then the people who use violence to take power will keep power using violence. And so for me, a violent revolution just is you're going to end up with a system that's just as bad, if not worse. But nevertheless, the Russian Revolution happened with a tiny percentage of the Russian population. Like the vast majority of the Russian population probably didn't know it had happened even 6 months later. So it's not the end of the world if we don't get the mainstream on board.
No, although I guess it would be helpful if people did realise that everybody they're dealing with is a corporation trading for profit. You know, not just the obvious corporations like McDonald's and the rest of them, but people like the police and the courts and almost everything is in the business of making money and then making more money. It's not in the business of making the stuff or growing the stuff that people actually need. I mean, I think that it seems to me, talking to people, that a lot of the obesity problems that we just referred to are not necessarily because people are eating too much, although that is the case in a lot of cases. It's because the stuff they're eating is rubbish and there's nothing left. The human body is basically a system for refining things into energy. And when you're talking white sugar and white flour and all these other things, there's nothing left to refine.
So, yeah, I mean, yeah, definitely corporations don't exist to fulfill our needs. They exist to make a profit, and they have to. I mean, if they try to do anything else, then they would lose their market share, and they'd lose money for their shareholders, and that would be the end for them. So they have to do that. Their hands are tied. I don't think there are sort of evil people at the top of the corporate hierarchy. Although being a nasty, ruthless person wouldn't hold you back, I don't think it's about nasty individuals. I think it's about the system that forces people to behave in a certain way.
Yeah, I agree. Not by and large. I think there's a few pretty nasty people at the top of most of these things, because you don't actually get to the top. Although maybe some of them just aren't thinking. But a lot of people, because it's all now money based, and because you haven't got access to your own land to grow your own food, people need to do things that they might not otherwise do just to keep food on the table and keep the mortgage hoax running and all that kind of stuff.
I went back to Christmas time. I went back and spent an evening with 10 guys I was at school with, so, and some of them I hadn't seen for decades. It was really, really interesting. They wanted to know what I was doing, and I told them, and they all had the same opinion. And I actually said to one of them, I said, do you think I'm pissing into the wind? Am I allowed to say that word on your station?
Yeah, go for it. Yeah, it's fine.
I said, do you think I'm pissing into the wind? And he said, no, I don't think you're pissing into the wind. I think you're pissing into a hurricane. I think you're wasting your time. You may as well just enjoy your life and die. And I said, but do you disagree with my points? Do you disagree that actually we're headed for ecological catastrophe, and the corporate sector is destroying democracy? And they all said, well, duh. Yeah, of course of course that's the case. But what do you want us to do about it? We're just ordinary blokes. We like to watch football. We like to drink beer. What can we possibly do about it? And there wasn't any dissenting voice from that line. That was the line. It was like, yeah, okay, that's fine. We agree with you. And so I said, well, if something started to happen, if a tiny minority of us started a ball rolling, would you kick against it? And they said, no, of course not. This system's shit. We would be happy if it changed, but we don't think it can, and we're not going to waste our lives trying. So I think there's a groundswell out there who wouldn't actually be too upset if something started to change. But I don't think they're going to do it. I don't think change is going to come from the majority. I think it's going to come from a minority. The kind of people who are listening to this program now, the people who get it and want to do something about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point, isn't it? That definitely the first part of taking some action is actually realizing that something's going on, and there are a whole lot more people who realize that's the case now. The second part is definitely realizing that something can be done, which does seem to be a bit of a stumbling block. But the third part is realizing that that you personally are responsible. We are all responsible for the way this thing is going, and taking even small bits of action can make a difference. Like you say, it's not going to be a majority, and it's not going to be probably big actions either. It's going to be a myriad of tiny things being done that work. I take it as basically probably quite an optimistic point that more people do realize that they don't like what we've got and that they're not going to kick against any attempts to change it. I think there's probably another whole chunk of people out there who aren't doing anything because, a bit like me, really, you just don't want to stick your head above the parapet to have it shot off. But I suspect that a lot of them...
Like you.
What?
A bit like you.
Yeah.
With the People's Internet Radio.
Well, I...
That's not sticking your head above the parapet.
It was that. That was when I started sticking my head above the parapet.
Oh, see, okay.
Yeah, because I basically found a lot of people who I really respected and heard talking a lot of sense, and I thought, oh, hey, I'm going to join in with that. And, you know, the more the kind of action there is being promoted by people like People's Internet Radio and lowimpact.org, the more these people are going to step out of the shadow into which they've accidentally fallen and start joining in. Quite apart from anything else, it's a lot more fun than just lying down and taking a kicking.
Yeah. I don't think we're going to stir up the majority to do very much at all, ever. I think they will follow. If things start to change and things start to roll, I think most people will take the path of least resistance. I think they'll take the easiest option, and I think it's down to the people who get it to come up with a plan. How are we going to change this? Nothing we're doing yet is enough. The corporate grip on the steering wheel gets stronger every year, and global ecology gets worse every year. I don't think anything that we're doing yet is anywhere near enough. But I'm very optimistic, because it could just take one idea. You never know what's around the corner. There have been lots of contenders. You know, the cooperative movement was going to be it, and it wasn't. It's a very, very good thing, and I think it should be supported. I think it's a great thing, the cooperative movement, but it's not it. It didn't do it. Neither did parliamentary change. After the Second World War, you know, there was quite a big sea change in society through Parliament, through the Labour Party, the creation of the National Health Service. It was a big sea change, but it wasn't enough. It was a blip. It slipped back to exactly the way it was before, of massive inequalities and concentration of power. So that way is not going to do it. And if any particular government anywhere in the world tries to challenge the corporate system, they'll be crushed in the same way. What's happened to Syriza will happen everywhere. Almost all Western governments are totally compliant, and they're totally on board with the corporate program.
Which basically brings us to another of your light bulb moments, apart from the fact that there's no food shortage and that we're facing an extinction crisis, is this idea that the governments are not actually in control, which is another suggestion that I find people tend to take a little bit askance, and they're a bit surprised by that idea.
I'm also surprised about how many people get that point immediately. I've been talking recently with bankers who work in the city, and they get that point immediately. They understand, and they don't like the system. They just have found a way to make a bit of money and pay their mortgage and live comfortably from it, but they don't like it. And they know where the real power is, and they know it's not with governments. You have to look at the amount of money that is spent just on a US presidential election alone. It costs the corporate sector between $5 and $7 billion, and nobody can compete with that with those figures. And if they could, then the corporate sector would up their game. That's where all the money is. So, you know, they don't donate that amount of money for nothing at all. They don't do it for fun. They don't do it for charity. They do it because they want payback. And of course, they have to have payback. The corporate lobby industry, there's about 100 professional corporate lobbyists for every politician in Washington. And the revolving door, I don't know if you know, the revolving door is, you know, retiring ministers end up on the board of multinational corporations with huge salaries, and sometimes that happens in the States while they're still in office.
It's happening here as well, according to Private Eye. I almost think that, you know, it's a kind of promise that seems to go with the job. Look, if you're willing to be a puppet that takes a kicking for a few years by being in government, then we'll make sure you're comfortable thereafter. Yeah. And I think the most, if you like, in your face example of it recently has been, because it works the other way around as well, so that a lot of the guys that were nominally in charge of the banks before the 2008 so-called banking crisis, now find themselves in positions where, in government, where they're actually in charge of ensuring financial probity.
Yeah.
So the revolving door is a revolving door. You can move from the corporation into politics and then back out of politics and into the corporation. Which of course
that's corruption pure and simple. Political donations, the lobby industry, the revolving door, it's pure corruption. And yet it's tolerated and it's seen to be kosher, and it's absolutely not.
And again, I guess it's one of the signs of the apathy that I guess we're talking about at the moment is the fact that people know that this, well, I don't know how many people do know about the revolving door actually, but most people do know that politicians are lying to them, but they still continue to turn up and vote for them.
Yeah.
Do you think that's one of the places where we might be able to see a marked change? Because it does seem to me to be a weak point in the system, in as far as if nobody turned up to vote, it'd give them a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, it's a difficult one, isn't it? I mean, I've got friends who they're in the Green Party and they campaign for the Green Party, and I try to explain to them that, yeah, I like Green Party supporters. I tend to agree with most of the things they say, except the fact that they think they can change things through the parliamentary route. Mm. And not only is it highly unlikely in my lifetime that the Green Party will ever form a government. It'd be great if they did, but their hands would be tied. They'd be shown the realities of where governments are in the hierarchy, and if they tried to do anything about that, they would end up in the same position as Syriza is now.
And so there's
very little chance of winning the next election in Greece.
No, and we've seen that really on a smaller scale here as well, in that on the odd occasion that you do get independent minds into Parliament who are actually willing to stay true to their cause and continue to argue from a given point of view, then they do tend to get sidelined, don't they? They don't find themselves in positions of influence. It's ultimately a compliance game once again.
I mean, the ownership of the media is one of the corporate sector's trump cards, isn't it? But again, this is where the internet can come in, and we have radio stations like this and independent websites and newspapers and magazines, and I think more people are starting to get their information and their news from non-corporate. I haven't seen the figures for that, though. I mean, that would be very interesting, actually, to see where people got their information from.
I wonder if anybody's even collecting the figures, and if they are, whether they'd actually make them public.
Still, the vast majority get their news and their opinion from corporate sources, so it's not surprising that the majority are not exactly up in arms.
I do find that really surprising, because in my opinion, the quality of the things that I'm finding on YouTube and internet radio and the rest is so far and away more gripping and better informed and better put across and better expressed than what I see on the mainstream media. I always, for years, have been fairly dissatisfied with people like Babylon Broadcasting, and certainly the national papers. I never really got on with them at all. But it really surprises me that nowadays, when I look at the BBC or when I do kind of catch the headlines, I find that they're just kind of derisory. It's almost like you have to be asleep to be reading them.
Yeah, I think cause for optimism is the fact that the younger generation seem to be rejecting the mainstream media. They tend towards social media and YouTube and independent sources for their information. I think a lot of them. Mm. I think it's they're moving away from the mainstream media, the TV and the newspapers.
I'm actually amazed by how many of the youngsters do seem to be fairly on the ball in terms of what's going on, what's happening around them. I suspect that younger minds can probably watch what the adults are doing and perhaps see through it a little bit better than the entrained adults can. A lot of them are not yet in the position, though, where they realise that they can actually do something about it as individuals. But I'm sure that will change. Because, see, they're being robbed of opportunity, aren't they? When you look at what the education system's doing and what, for want of a better word, we'll call employment opportunities and things like that, they are almost going to be forced to be independent and different, because the system is ceasing to provide them even with the illusion of what they need.
We'll see what the next the younger generation come up with.
What about technology? Do you think technology is a genuine solution, or can be a genuine solution?
This is another area where I sort of part company with some environmentalists, because again, they don't recognize the problem of ownership of technology. I've had discussions with people who said, wouldn't it be great if we had a giant satellite the size of the moon beaming back clean solar energy to Earth, which would provide all of our energy needs? The obvious question is, well, great, but who owns it? Who's going to own that kind of technology? It's going to be corporate controlled. So do you really want the corporate sector to own our entire energy supply? Is that a good idea? I really don't think it is. There's a book called Tools for Conviviality by Ivan Illich, and he makes the distinction between convivial technology and non-convivial technology. And what he means is convivial technology is technology that can be owned and controlled by individuals and communities, like solar panels on your roof, like growing your own veg, like wood stoves. There are plenty of technologies that can be controlled and owned by individuals and communities. And the non-convivial technology is the technology that just can't. It can only really be owned and controlled by corporations, like nuclear power, like GM technology, nanotechnology. There are lots of technologies that can only be controlled by corporations, and he saw that as another tool to concentrate wealth and power in the 1%.
Yeah, I guess effectively it's part of what seems to be a pretty pervasive trend of ceding responsibility for any of this stuff to somebody else rather than taking responsibility ourselves.
Talking about this 1%, I've heard that next year, 2016, is the year that for the first time in history, the wealthiest 1% control as much wealth as the other 99. That's never happened before in history. I don't know if you've come across that. I'll have to look that up again. But
yeah, I have seen that.
I'm pretty sure that's the case. Well, that means we live in a system which has concentrated power and wealth more than the height of the British Empire, the Mongol Empire, the Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire. All those fabulously lopsided empires don't come close to the corporate empire when it comes to concentration of wealth and power. And of course, if you give it enough time, it will be, and I don't know how long, but we're headed towards a situation where 0.1% of the population control as much wealth as the other 99.9%. Mm-hmm. A bit further, it's 0.01%. It's getting more and more and more concentrated each year. That's quite a chilling thought.
It certainly is, and the movement that way appears to be going faster and faster. At the same time, it might be a good idea to take a good hard look at just exactly what kind of wealth that is, because, of course, a lot of the wealth that people have got is entirely illusory, but it does seem to me that a substantial portion of the wealth is in the form of land and materials and things rather than so-called money.
Yeah, it's obviously a lot of money is just, there are more financial transactions in the world than could possibly relate to actual physical goods and services and things that actually happen in the real world. So it doesn't relate exactly to the real world. It's an imaginary world, largely. And if all those chips if people attempted to cash in all those chips at the same time, there's nothing in reserve to pay it. Mm. But it brings you power. It brings you power and influence. And that's the problem, I think. It has massive repercussions for democracy. In fact, it makes democracy absolutely impossible.
Well, and again, if we're going to talk about democracy, we might as well face the fact that democracy itself is a bit of a mockery now. In that I didn't look into it too much, but I'm deeply, deeply suspicious about the last election we had and about whether the votes that were actually cast were the ones that are actually ultimately counted. And then there's the fact that it does seem to me to be the registration of your vote that they're interested in rather than whether you actually cast it or not. And it seems to me that that, again, is a system that needs to be radically overhauled.
But then again, if you can only elect a pro-corporate party, and even if there was a chance that you could elect an anti-corporate party, there'd be nothing that party could do, not within this system. And so, for me, I'm not really concerned about focusing on the voting system. Mm. Does that make sense?
No, I think not. I did meet a man on the street market in Llanidloes who's running an interesting campaign. I'm hoping to talk to him again. What he's hoping to do, I think, is concentrate on key marginal constituencies in Wales and try and convince swing voters, as it were, to try and encourage a vote to get parties to commit to remove power from politics and corporations and put it back in the hands of the people and get them to commit to that, otherwise to get people to vote for them, which I think is quite an interesting and innovative idea. He seems to have a fair bit of support.
It's interesting. It just needs some idea to capture the public's imagination and take off, like Syriza did in Greece or like Podemos are doing in Spain. I came across one guy, I think he was in the southeast somewhere, and he stood as an independent, and he said, for every single thing that I vote on, if you elect me as your MP, for every single thing that I vote on in Parliament, I will hold a referendum in my constituency, and I will just do exactly what people tell me to do. I thought that was quite interesting. Sort of direct democracy through the parliamentary route.
Yeah. Well, direct democracy does seem to be another thing that's kind of that's up and coming, and eventually this deeply wounded creature that we're running now is surely going to be replaced by something else.
Yeah, it's just what, though, isn't it? I mean, I've been considering holding a competition on the Low Impact website for people to send us an article about their idea about something that could help change the system, and then we could use the likes and shares for the people, for the visitors to the website, to vote on them. And then have some sort of a gathering somewhere, so that people could come together and discuss it and say, okay, what are we going to do? A bit like the old internationals, you know, at the end of the 19th century.
Yeah.
I think they're still happening somewhere, but they're not really happening. There's not much happening there.
It's interesting that, isn't it? I'll just sort of veer off a little bit to another thing that I was reading about on the Low Impact website. I was reading about the beehives with the honey draw off tap on them, and of course there's a huge debate as to whether or not that's a good thing, which I don't think we'll get into here. But what amazed me about that was that according to the blog there, they got $70,000 worth of crowdfunding in 8 minutes, and eventually raised $12 million for that particular project. Now that, I thought, was a real eye opener. I thought, bloody hell, you know, if you come up with an idea that is going to attract people, it is perhaps possible to get the resource you need to bring it into reality. I thought it was one of the most surprising things I read, and also really, again, you know, there's possibility for change there in as far as, you know, the money's useful at the moment.
Well, I mean, that was an invention that I think people were signing up for that for personal gain.
Yeah.
They thought, here's an easy way to get honey. I'll have that. It's been massively criticised by natural beekeepers.
Yes, I shall be talking to some natural beekeepers about it, hopefully, in the not-too-distant future, because I had a lady called... two or three of them on the show actually a few weeks back, and I'm sure I know for a fact that they won't like the idea, but I was just interested in the fact that the idea did attract a lot of, I guess you don't know where the cash came from, do you? You don't know whether it came from thousands of individuals or whether it came from corporations, but nonetheless, an idea did.
I'm pretty sure it came from individuals, because what you get a flow hive once the project's up and running. You get a flow hive, and I'm pretty sure it was almost all individuals. But it was for personal gain. It wasn't for social change or you know, changing the system. It was for personal gain. So it's a different ball game that we're talking about, really.
Yeah, I suppose so. I suppose so. Well, a lot of those, I mean, if all of those people get a flow hive, they're going to be incredibly disappointed if they think they can just get themselves a beehive and a bunch of bees and just pull the honey out of the bottom of it.
Well, I mean, they might be able. That's exactly what they might be able to do, but it might not be very good for the bees. It's most people who get a flow hive probably won't be experienced beekeepers, and they will see it as a little honey factory, and really. What natural beekeepers are saying that we should be taking much less honey than we already take, and bees are in trouble all over the world, and we really shouldn't be giving them any more trouble. We should be helping them, and helping them by taking less honey.
Yeah,
the flow hive is designed to make taking honey a lot easier.
I think that point that we need to be concentrating on the bees, not on the honey, at this point is definitely the correct point. And the ones I was talking about say that they take very little honey. If any at all, and probably then only for medicinal purposes.
Yeah, I've been talking to people at the Natural Beekeeping Trust about whether honey production should actually be a commercial activity at all, or whether if you want honey, then put yourself a little natural beehive down the bottom of your garden, and then just take a couple of jars a year. You know, just but it's not it's a it's a it should be an extreme luxury, and we're pushing bees so hard and giving them sugar water over the winter, which really isn't good for them. Honey is good for them. Surprise! And it's we're going to be causing them all sorts of problems. And of course, the ubiquity of pesticides everywhere now means that that's going to cause them big problems as well. And again, you know, you can't put right the world for bees without changing the system. You can't suddenly have healthy bees in this toxic system.
No.
But for me, it always ends up pointing back towards systemic change.
Yeah. Yeah, basically, if we want to look after ourselves, we have to look after the system that looks after us, and that definitely includes the bees and more or less everything else, because, I mean, going back to the idea of endangered critters and stuff, basically each one of them that goes extinct, and they're going extinct at quite a rate at the moment, just moves us further up the list. And I mean, they reckon we haven't even discovered most of the animals yet, have we? There's loads of them under the sea and in the jungles that we haven't even seen or know nothing about.
We discovered a tiny, tiny proportion of the number of animals and plants on the planet. Every time they really look at a small patch of rainforest in a particular part of the world, they discover thousands of new species, and we just haven't got the resources to do that kind of research all over the world. But no, they know for sure that we have only discovered a tiny percentage of all the creatures in the world.
Mm. So just returning to the technology idea, I mean, at the moment it's all kind of, by and large, even if somebody comes up with something that's a really good idea, it's fairly quickly subsumed by corporate interests. It becomes growth-oriented, competitive, and basically part of the hierarchy. I've been wondering about sort of decentralized research and development, because another thing that's going on the internet is that there's a whole lot of investigation of alternative energy generation and, you know, disappearing patents from people like Schauberger and Tesla and the rest. But and I have met some people who've made some very interesting machines, but they all seem to be interested in patenting them or copywriting them or whatever it is and making money out of them. I wonder what would happen if somebody actually devised something, made it work, came up with the drawings and just published it on the internet for free.
Well, that's what Satoshi Nakamoto did with cryptocurrencies, with the Bitcoin code, and There was, I don't know where that's going to go, but there's certainly huge potential for that to challenge the financial system. And nobody knows. He did it completely free. He just said, "Here's a code, go and use it." Bye. Mm-hmm. And nobody knows who he was, and he came up with this idea, this perfectly formed idea for starting Bitcoin, cryptocurrency.
And of course there's a fair bit of debate about that, isn't there? Because once again it's an idea that seems to work pretty well, and presumably the world management team will be extremely interested in it, because what they actually seem to want is a digital currency and the removal of cash.
Yeah, but this one can't be really controlled by banks. There's absolutely no need for banks with Bitcoin. They're redundant. I don't know, you must follow Max Keiser.
Yeah, I think he's great. He's very funny, quite apart from anything else.
The Kaiser Report, yeah. And he said, you know, it's game over. He was wrong, obviously. There are still, the banks still exist, but he said that it was the beginning of the end for banks. It was game over. Banks just aren't required anymore when you can use cryptocurrencies. I don't know.
No. Have you had any personal experience of them, or are there people on low impact that are actually actively investigating them and using them for trading and swapping and the rest?
No, we're going to take Bitcoins. We're going to look into it. But it hasn't taken off in the way that it was thought that it might. Although Bitcoin is quite big now. I mean, it's, I'm going to keep looking at it and see what happens there. But that's something. That's something that was invented and given to the world, and it as far as I know, not for personal gain.
Mm.
Just to challenge the global financial system.
Which is really great. We I think that the one of the points that's raised on the website is that we need to be generating and developing things as a result of need rather than as a result of profit. And that basically we need to be concentrating on community-owned businesses, co-ops, which is still, although the big co-op didn't seem to come to much, it's still a very valid structure for setting up new things, I think. Yeah. And what about distributism? That's something that it isn't a word I'd come across before I looked at your website. What would you like to explain what that is for us?
Well, it was a philosophy that was actually born out of the Catholic Church towards the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, and it came from a speech by a pope at the end of the 19th century, and it was taken up by the Catholic Workers' Movement and Dorothy Day, and G.K. Chesterton was a distributist, and so was Hilaire Belloc, and there was a famous debate between G.K. Chesterton and George Bernard Shaw at the beginning of the 30s, I think. And Stalinism hadn't quite morphed into the horror that it was to become at the time. And George Bernard Shaw was speaking in favor of the Soviet Union as an alternative to corporate capitalism. And G.K. Chesterton said yes, but it was a violent revolution, which meant that you needed soldiers to take power. You needed military men to take power. And that's where Marx's idea was wrong. And we're here in the 30s, and those military men are still in power because they're never going to give that power up. And he said that is inevitably going to happen. And what you need to do is you need to distribute power more thinly throughout society. Now, the beauty of this is that ordinary people can just do it by thinking about where they spend their money. So they were talking about moving wealth and power away from the corporate sector and towards independent businesses, self-employed people, family farms, small holdings, community-owned enterprises, co-ops, and the not-for-profit sector. So really spread the wealth and spread the power throughout society. And G.K. Chesterton said something interesting. He said that the problem with capitalism is not that there are too many capitalists, but that there are too few capitalists. And so if you spread the means of production throughout society, so everybody has their own tools and everybody can look after themselves, either individually or in a cooperative team with other like-minded people, then that's the best way to organize society. Now, that's the kind of capitalism that Adam Smith would recognize. He was writing before global corporations, and therefore he couldn't have possibly imagined what was going to happen to the free market, the so-called free market, which is now anything but free. It's completely corporate controlled.
Certainly is.
But the distributist idea is about flattening the hierarchy. So move your money, get your money out of the corporate banks, put it in a credit union, put it in a cooperative bank. Not the cooperative banks, that's not cooperative anymore. It's been swallowed by the corporate sector. Get it into... Well, I'm also on the board of the Ecological Land Co-op, and the Ecological Land Co-op you can get a 3% return on your investment in the Ecological Land Co-op, and they use it to buy pockets of land and turn them into sustainable settlements. Community energy. I know somebody who runs a company called Share Energy, and they help set up community energy projects. They're promising a 7% return, and so some of the returns you can invest in Radical Roots, in housing and worker co-ops. there are lots of places that you can invest your money. Actually, on the low impact website, on the homepage, one of the boxes is move your money. And it tells you some of the places that you can move your money to, out of the corporate banking system and into places where actually it's not charity. You'll get a better return on your money, but your money will be doing something useful instead of making profits for the corporate sector. And that's distributism.
That's a very interesting page, that one. I like that one. I've just put the link for it into the chat box.
Now, here's an interesting thing. I was at a public demonstration at a local pub. I live in Tooting in southwest London, and there's a local pub going to be taken over by Tesco. So I went along to the demo.
No, not the pubs.
And I started to talk to this guy, and he was dressed in sort of scruffy jeans and t-shirt and a bit of stubble, and so was I. And we just chatting, and he, you know, when you meet people and you think, oh yeah, I like this guy. We're speaking the same language. And we were chatting away about how, you know, Tesco will never be satisfied. They will always want to more and more and more. And I liked him. And he walked off, and his mate said to me, do you know who that is? And I said, no. He said, that's your local Tory candidate for MP. And I was aghast. I was like, really? Really? He said, yes. And so, and actually I got to know him a bit better, and I started talking to him, and I think I know what you are. I think you're a distributist, even though you're a Tory, because he believed in the free market, and he believes in small independent businesses and pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and all this sort of, you know, personal responsibility, which is and freedom, which are sort of right-wing principles. And I said, I think you might be a distributist. And so I gave him some literature, and I pointed him to a few websites, and I showed him to a couple of the blog articles on our website, and he came back and he said, yes, I think I'm a distributist. I am. That's exactly what I want. I want power spread thinly throughout society. And I was just flabbergasted, and I said, you do realize I've got an email from you now which says that you actually agree with me and you're a distributist. And I could use that against you if you ever become an MP. I think you will become an MP. He narrowly lost to Sadiq Khan. Mm-hmm. And I think the Labour Party is about to implode, to be honest. And so I think he's got a very good chance of being an MP next time.
Well, he sounds like an entirely new breed of Tory. But I mean, the capitalist thing is quite interesting, because I it's a word I've thought about a lot. And basically, if what we had was capitalism, we possibly would have fewer problems than we've actually got, in as far as distribution of land and tools and things actually make it possible for people to kind of maintain their own wealth. But it has to be faced that the right-wing governments, well, we'll talk about right and left-wing perhaps after a bit of a music break, but the governments we've had over recent years have, as has been pointed out to me several times, actually implemented between them 9 out of the 10 planks of communism that you can find on the internet. So, well, they're kind of posing as one thing but actually doing the other, which really, that fact in itself seriously blurs the line between what is right and what is left of centre, I think.
Yeah. I mean, it's this guy is seriously anti-corporate. He doesn't want corporations taking over our high streets and our economy. He doesn't want that. He wants it to be small independent businesses. And he actually mentioned cooperatives by name. You know, he said, yes, I'm really into cooperatives. He's interested in what the Ecological Land Co-op are doing. He's a good guy. I like him. And I've told him clearly that never in a million years is he going to get my vote as long as he's a member of the Tory Party. But as an individual, I like him. And he's the difference between us, and we've talked about this as well. If you keep flattening the hierarchy, then unless you stop at some point, you're going to end up with a system which is basically anarchic. You're going to end up with anarchism if you keep flattening the system until it's as flat as it can possibly be. You're in this system which is, you know, the political philosophy which dare not speak its name, mm-hmm. because anarchism has been misused so much to mean chaos and violence, when actually it means superb organization. And I said to him, I said, you know, if and when we get to a distributive society, if that's ever possible, the difference between us is that you would probably want to stop there, and I probably wouldn't. I don't want to take it further. And he said, yeah, yeah, that's probably the difference between us.
Mm. So you see, as you put on the website, you see distributism as a kind of vehicle for the achievement of anarchism. And I agree, very, very brave word to be putting on a website, that is. People do get very hot and flustered when you start talking about anarchism or anarchy.
Well, I heard David Holmgren, one of the founders of the permaculture movement, which I've never considered a massively political movement, but perhaps I'm wrong. And I saw a talk by David Holmgren the other day, and he started it by saying, look, I'm an anarchist. Let's put it out there. I am. I don't want a hierarchical society, because if you have a hierarchical society, the wrong kinds of people tend to get to the top of it.
Yes, if there's a top to get to, that is, I think, almost certainly the case. I think it's probably been a very, 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 very long time since we saw a hierarchy which actually had benevolent, competent, well-informed, generous, warm-hearted people at the top of it.
Really? What was that hierarchy? I missed that one.
I think it's been a long time since we've seen a hierarchy that's had sort of generous, warm-hearted, clear-thinking people actually at the top of it.
I would suggest that there's never been one.
No, I don't think I've come across one. It's been suggested to me that it's the cream that rises to the top, in the sense of ultimately the rich and thick.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, we've been chatting for an hour or so. I could certainly do with a wee break, so perhaps it's time to put a couple of tunes on for the people and have a bit of a break from the microphone.
A little break or a break to have a wee?
Both of those. I've got about 8.5 minutes of music lined up, so I'm going to stick on New Beginnings by Opaque, because I think that's what we've been talking about and what we need to see. And you're listening, of course, to Dr. Rock chatting with Dave Darby of lowimpact.org on peoplesinternetradio.com. There we go, that was my friend Jakey Z and Song for the Rebellion, and before that, Opaque and New Beginnings. You're back listening live to Dr. Rock's radio show, where tonight's guest is Dave Darby from lowimpact.org. Welcome back, Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Rock. Thanks for having me.
That's great. It's great to have you on. It's a real privilege chatting with you, chap, it is. You've got, as well as the stuff that you're putting on the website, as you've said, you've got a lot of very useful contributors, and I thought on the light bulb moments, some of which we've been talking about in the first part of the show, one of your contributors, Andrew Rollinson, brought up the subject of education and the idea of actually building on the stuff we've got in the past rather than kind of preventing or obscuring access to it. Do you think that that sites such as yours and the internet generally is going to be, in the long run, it wouldn't be difficult to be a better source of education than people are getting at school, would it?
Yeah, that's a tricky one as well, isn't it? It does. The education system does seem to exist just to produce workers for the corporate system. There's the national curriculum. It doesn't really leave much room for critical thought along the lines of, is this the best possible system that we could live under? That's sort of a given. And the education system is seen to be feeding into the economic system, and ultimately it's all about increasing economic growth. My missus has just knocked on the door, Ben. I'll go and let her in.
Yeah, oh yeah, go for it. Yeah, don't leave her on the doorstep. There could be all sorts of trouble.
Copy, 1 second.
I think there's some great ideas on the lowimpact.org website. The more I look at it, the more I'm entertained by it. I was looking at a page which is about philosophy. I shall just endeavour to put the link into the chat box. It starts with a quote from a man called Edward Abbey, who says, "Freedom begins between the ears," which I think is highly relevant to the subject of education. Because of course, if we're going to be free, and it begins between the ears, then we're onto a winner, aren't we? Because there's not a lot people can do about that. And the little bit of philosophy, I think, is really great. Says that it's a difficult topic to define, but it puts up a few attempts, and kicks off with the love of wisdom, which I think is really great, isn't it? Because we don't see a lot of wisdom in the world we're in. Have you let the missus in then, Dave?
Yeah.
Very good. I've just
she's in. Have you seen the Edward Abbey play?
No, it's the first time I've come across his name, but that quote alone is enough to make me want to give him a bit more of a listen. And if that's a photo of him, he really does look like my sort of chap.
Yeah, you'd absolutely love him. You'd love him. You should give him a go.
No, I mean, really, I sort of popped there just to kind of just to fill in the gap whilst you answer the door. But looking at it, it's actually bang on the subject of education, because in trying to define philosophy, we've got the love of wisdom, which is a bit of a classical idea, and the investigation of ideas, which I guess is what it's all about, isn't it? Both here on PIR and Low Impact, and is something that we're not necessarily seeing an awful lot of in the political world that we're inhabiting.
No. We've started a philosophy club, believe it or not, in Tooting, in Southwest London, and it was just very speculative. I thought, you know, people don't get to talk philosophically very much in their lives. They tend to talk about day-to-day business, or they tend to talk about work. And, you know, it's philosophy is not something you get to talk very much about. So I thought, well, try and start this club where we meet in each other's homes and we have food and we have drink. And we talk about philosophy. And we started it 2.5 years ago now. And people absolutely love it. There's 15 people with a waiting list, and people absolutely love it. And we talk about a different subject each month. It's one evening a month that we get together. And I have always thought that if we are going to build an alternative political system, then people need to come together in their neighborhoods and talk and discuss, you know, bigger things than just, you know, day-to-day topics or personal things. And I was really surprised how, and there's all sorts of people in the group. There's a builder, there's an acupuncturist, there's a psychiatrist, there's me, there's a very diverse group of people.
Well, an absolutely fabulous idea. I mean, I personally, I think it's a good idea just getting people together to eat and chat. But it does sound like what you're engaging in is the opposite of small talk. Do people find themselves sort of growing as a result? Is it what sort of topics are you discussing?
Well, the next one is about death, and it's not sort of really really specific questions. It's just sort of a topic that we can talk about. And the next subject is death. But we've talked about, one of the weeks it was, do we need a revolution? So that was quite a heated one. And we've, I think the last one was, why are people taken in by strong, in inverted commas, leaders? Why are strong leaders so popular? And that was a very interesting discussion as well.
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting question, actually, because the best leaders I've come across in my own personal life are people who actually, if they're really good at it, they're actually quite background, really. They're in the way things run around them.
Yeah. Well, this is an interesting subject, really, because I'm sort of a natural, I lean towards anarchism, as we mentioned earlier. My missus works in the NHS, and she's on a leadership program, so that's caused a few interesting conversations between us. But I'm reading a book at the moment by Michael Albert, Paracon. It's called Paracon, which is short for Participatory Economy, and It was recommended to me by somebody who works for Low Impact, and it's fantastic. It's an anarchist vision of what society might be like in great detail, and he's obviously a very clever chap. What's missing is an implementation program, which is the thing that's usually missing. But he did say that even in an anarchist society, there would be a need for leadership. Leaders would be required, but it's just that they wouldn't be able to force people to follow them. People would follow them because they wanted to follow them.
Yeah, and because under any given circumstance, there are certain people generally who are more qualified at any given time to be at the front of a crew pulling something off, and it, you know, might not be the same person for a different job. But by
exactly. Having lived at a community for 13 years, it was a consensus decision-making community. And you know, nobody was in charge. It was a group of 15 to 17 adults who made decisions by consensus in a weekly meeting. And a lot of people found that very, very difficult to get their head around. Somebody must be in charge. And the answer is no, nobody was in charge. We were all strong enough personalities to make sure that nobody took charge. But when it came to building work, we knew who had the experience with building work, and they became leaders for that project. We knew who the good gardeners were, and they were leaders in their particular little field. And so natural leaders emerged and then withdrew again when they were out of their area of expertise. And there's nothing wrong with that at all.
That's exactly right. I think that's a great way of running it. So that was that the Redfield community?
That's right, yeah.
Because that's been going for quite some time now, hasn't it?
Since 1978, and it's the founders of Redfield were fantastic people. They in the founding documents, they made sure that the community could never be sold for the personal gain of the people who happened to be living there at the time. It was bought for £70,000 in 1978. So a group of 10 people got together and put in £7,000 each. And they were able to buy this massive Victorian mansion with stable block and 20 acres of pasture and woodland and orchards and gardens. And it's now worth £5 million, but if it's ever sold, then the money must go to other cooperative organizations. It's a registered housing co-op, so it would have to go to other cooperative organizations, or they could use the money to start a new community. Mm-hmm. But they couldn't put it in their pocket. It's not possible. So it's not a personal investment. You don't have to pay any money to join. You don't get any money when you leave. You just start paying a rent to the co-op. So you immediately, when you're accepted, you immediately become a landlord and a tenant at the same time.
Very good. So it's still going strong. Does it have a waiting list?
It's full. I don't know if it's got a waiting list. I was there for 13 years, actually, but I left 6 years ago. I go back to parties and I still know them all. It's a really, really good model. And there are lots of other communities in Britain, some of which you have to buy into. You either buy your unit or you buy a share in the entire property. But the problem is that the value of your share will rise with, you know, the price of housing. And And that's problematic because that means you have to have some money to join. Whereas I joined in 1996 with a bike and a rucksack.
And the ability to pay rent.
And the ability to pay rent because I've always worked, yeah.
Yeah. Because I think, again, communities are a major idea. It's something that I've personally been investigating for the last 4 years or so as we've wandered around the place living one way and the other in lots and lots of different circumstances, and I've seen a lot of dysfunctional communities and not very many, it has to be said, that work well. So it's good to hear one. It's somewhere that I'd like to visit, in fact, Redfield, because I've heard a lot of people talk about it.
It's a very good model, and wonderful people and great parties as well. there aren't so many of these big Victorian mansions left, and if there are, they're very expensive now. That's not structurally, the actual infrastructure, I don't think it's a good model. But if we're going to have if there's going to be a future for communities, then they have to be new communities and new build communities. And that's where people like Lammas and the Ecological Land Co-op come in. I suppose I'm teaching my grandmother to suck eggs if I'm talking to your listeners about Lammas and taking back the land, or am I not?
No, I think it's worth talking a little bit more about that, because I'm aware that we don't necessarily get into the details of community living very much. It's certainly one of the things that this show likes to try and concentrate on. It would be good that there's bound to be people in the chat box who don't know a lot about Lammas, so telling them a bit about how it works would be great.
A group of people came together several years ago in Pembrokeshire, and they helped Pembrokeshire Council to write their low impact development policy, and then they use that same policy to say, right, we want to buy this 150 acre farm, and we want to split it into 5 acre plots, little small holdings, and leave the rest as community woodland. But we want you to allow the smallholders to build their own homes on their plots. Now, there's only two kinds of land in the UK. There's development land and there's open countryside. The development land, you're allowed to build on it. It's very, very expensive, and usually developers snap it up before anybody else gets the chance. Mm-hmm. And there's open countryside, which is relatively cheap, but you're not allowed to build anything on it at all, unless you're a farmer who farms more than, I think it's 10 hectares, and then you're allowed to put up a huge steel barn or anything you like, really, as long as it's large scale.
Yeah.
The planners don't really consider small scale farming and small holding as efficient or desirable. And so Lammas said, okay, well, we want to help repopulate the countryside with people who are actually working in the countryside. And if you let these people build their homes on their small holdings on this farm in Pembrokeshire, we will police it and we will own it in perpetuity, and we will make sure that these people abide by very strict environmental criteria, which we will publish in a management plan. And that includes things like the houses couldn't be above a certain size. They're not about building little palaces. They have to be built from local natural materials. They have to be off-grid, so they're harvesting all their own energy. They have to be off mains water, so they harvest rainwater and they compost loose. And they have to make most of their living from the land. And we will make sure that is the case in perpetuity. They lost. They went to appeal. They won. It was a UK precedent. And they want to start more communities. In fact, the Pembrokeshire low-impact development policy influenced the one planet development policy in the Welsh Assembly. So there's much more scope for doing that kind of thing in Wales now. But the Ecological Land Co-op, they did exactly the same thing in Devon. So they set a precedent for England, and they sort of Greenham Reach, smaller than Lammas. So it's three small holdings, about 5 acres each, and they were successful at appeal as well. And now they've got they're looking at their second parcel of land in Sussex to do a similar thing. And I've forgotten why we started talking about land issues. But, oh, yes, communities. So yeah. So that, I think, is the future for communities. So people, they have their own front door. They build their own sustainable home on a cooperative enterprise. They don't necessarily live very, very closely with each other and eat their meals together like they do at Redfield. I think Redfield is very communal. It's like a big family. And I think that it doesn't really suit everybody. And to be honest, if I went back to community living, I'd want my own individual space, and we could come together to eat meals maybe once a week or once a fortnight or something like that. That would suit me better. I think it's very difficult to live so closely with 15, 17, 20 other people.
It is, I agree, it is pretty intense doing communal meeting, lunch and supper every day.
Well, the meetings were once a fortnight.
Mm-hmm.
One evening a fortnight was the business meeting. There were lots of informal meetings, and we took it in turns to cook the evening meal. And we could be cooking an evening meal for, 25 people on average, including visitors and woofers and children. So that was, but then again, we didn't have to cook for 2 weeks. Again,
yeah.
Once we cooked. It's very nice to have a nice meal cooked for you every night, mostly from home produced food. We had gardens and soft fruit and orchards and pigs and sheep and chickens and bees. So there was, it was getting on for half our food was produced on site. We got the rest from, we had a Suma Whole Foods Co-op delivery for rice and pasta and things like that. Something I'm really, really glad I did.
I think it's really good. If nothing else, this conversation is showing us how versatile the cooperative model actually is, how many things it seems to be being used for now. It's great to hear that people are actually using it to get hold of land that people can live on, because that seems to me to be one of the biggest challenges we've got. It's awfully expensive to get one of these brick and cement and steel houses, and they don't look anything like as nice as the sort of locally sourced ones.
I think that really resonates with people. I think you'd be surprised at how many people given half the chance, would like a small holding and be able to build their own home and to live independently. And again, it's not a right and left. It's not a right or left thing. It's you know, for right wing people, the principles of independence and personal responsibility and freedom are important. And for people on the left, genuine people on the left and right, genuine people on the left, the principles of cooperation and equality and unity are more important. But all of those principles are really good principles. And there's no reason at all why they should be mutually exclusive, I don't think.
No, it's actually a unity, isn't it, that's been made to look like a division.
Yeah. And of course the corporate sector would be overjoyed if left and right continued their eternal battle and sort of let them off the hook and they were too busy fighting each other than trying to challenge the corporate sector.
Yeah, and get on with each other and find out how to make a bit of progress.
Yeah, I mean, there will be eternal differences between naturally left-leaning people and naturally right-leaning people. But those differences don't mean that we can't unite to defeat the corporate sector. It doesn't at all.
Mm. Well, I think the we shall certainly be getting in touch with the Ecological Land Cooperative and seeing if we can have a word with them and see how it's going and how they're making it work, because they're clearly moving forwards.
Very capable people.
And what they're after is investments, which takes us back to the thing we were talking about, investors, which takes us back to what we were talking about before the break, which is basically moving your money from places where it's making no kind of return at all into places where it will make a return and where it will actually enable people to manifest these sort of projects.
Yeah, if you've got, for this is something we've recently got into. For 15 years, Low Impact has been helping people largely who are time rich and money poor. So they have the time to learn skills such as natural building or renewable energy or food production or craft skills. And now I've realized that actually since I've been living in London, there are lots of people who are, you know, relatively well off, but they're still concerned about the way the world's going, and they would like to do their bit to change it, but they haven't got any time because they're professionals and they don't have any spare time at all. But they have a bit of money, and so they could put that money to good use as well. There are people doing wonderful things in community energy and community supported agriculture and land co-ops and land trusts and, you know, doing really wonderful things, and what they need is money. And there are people out there who would love to support them, and they do have a bit of spare cash. And so I would like to bring those two groups together.
Mm.
For mutual benefit.
Yeah, the Move Your Money page on the lowimpact.org website is certainly very exciting, I think. And plus the fact that if the money's going into things like this, I would bet that it's not being put into the main high street banks, which I think is another major solution, is to get our money out of there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I have a niece, plus her partner, and I have, you know, a nephew and his friends who are in their sort of early 20s, and they don't want to work in the corporate sector, but they don't have any alternative. They just don't know what to do, and they end up sort of selling mobile phones or you know, working in PR or just, and they know it's nonsense, but they can't see any alternative, and I sympathize with them. And so I think that, you know, people with a bit of money, they have a responsibility really to move it into places where we can build better futures for young people, you know, so they can get apprenticeships sort of with natural builders or with renewable energy installers or with smallholders or and this, of course, is where the WWF organization comes in. They do a fantastic job allowing people to leave the rat race and go WWFing, and they can support themselves. People get further and further into this mortgage trap, and they need to earn the money that they're earning in the corporate sector to maintain their lifestyle, when really, if given an option, they wouldn't have that lifestyle.
No, and actually access to the other sort of lifestyle has been very limited of late, I think, and it's great to see people opening it back up again. I think the WWFing thing is really fabulous. There are actually a whole lot of people moving around from one place to another helping out in such projects, and that means that you need very little money. So long as you can, get to where you're going, they'll feed you and keep you entertained. And there's quite often very interesting places to stay as well.
Interesting. And you just don't know who you're going to meet and what opportunities will be open to you. And you could very well find yourself in a totally new career after a woofing spell.
Yeah, it's certainly something I'd like to do a little bit more of, I think. Get around the place, see a few more places. There's plenty of places on the low impact place. You're actually kind of integrated with WOOF in some way now, aren't you?
Well, we ran the WOOF organization for 8 years, and that finished this year. It was because of a change in the EU law regarding VAT. Which meant that WOOF could split their operation into WOOF UK and WOOF Overseas for the purposes of VAT. So what that meant was WOOF could drop below the VAT threshold in the UK. And so, but we're above the VAT threshold, so we're VAT registered, so we would have to continue to charge them VAT for running their operations. Which means they would have lost £16,000-£20,000 a year, so it wasn't feasible for them to do that, and so we had to go our separate ways. But we still love WOOF. We still absolutely love WOOF, and we'll continue to promote WOOF. It's a wonderful organisation.
Mm-hmm.
So, ironically, after WOOF left us, we fell below the VAT threshold. But, yeah, nothing we can do about it at all.
God, VAT, what an iniquitous tax.
Yeah, isn't it?
Absolutely iniquitous. So what are WOOF doing now? They've got their own management team, have they?
They've got the same team, but their staff is, instead of being employed by Low Impact, is now employed by WOOF directly. But they never wanted to employ people directly. They wanted another organisation to run their operations. But they were sort of forced into that by VAT law. But it's been a great relationship between Low Impact and WOOF. I mean, WOOF was... Yeah, they weren't doing too well when we took them over, and we stabilised them and doubled their membership a couple of times, I think, and doubled their income. We it was a very good relationship for both of us.
Yeah, sounds like your administrative and organisational skills were very helpful there.
Not mine personally.
No, the low impact skills generally.
The low impact team, yes.
Mm.
I'm more of a political guy, really. I'm doing myself down. I'm quite well organised.
Yeah. Well, and again, you know, this is one of the things we were talking about earlier, wasn't it? That networking the networks is becoming ever more important. Given the scale of challenges we face, we really need to be working together across the board to be able to get any kind of significant results.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I would like to think that Low Impact could be the platform for a network of networks, but at the moment I'm the owner. I'm the director. So it's a sort of a benign dictatorship. It's not a democracy. So what I intend to do is to give it away, to give it away to a board of directors or board of trustees, whichever model we use, and draw those directors from the areas I've been talking about, from community energy, from community supported agriculture, from housing co-ops, worker co-ops, maybe even credit unions, maybe even cryptocurrencies. We'll see. But I know people in all those areas, and I know just excellent people. I keep trying to persuade them that they need to lift their heads up from their particular speciality from time to time and talk about what systemic change might look like and how to bring it about. Because if we don't do it, who's going to do it? It's the people working in those fields are going to be the people who are going to do it. I think we're going to do it by networking.
Yeah, well, they are mould breakers, aren't they? And we might as well break as many moulds together as we can.
Yeah.
So the I guess we might as well look at a little bit at what low impact actually means. I mean, we've talked a little bit about the difference between buying bricks and cement houses as against kind of getting a bit of land and starting to build local and naturally sourced kind of houses. By the way, what how does that go with the planning and the building regs and things like that if you want to build yourself a cob house or a straw bale? Is the same kind of stringency applied to those? Yeah, as is,
I don't have so much of a problem with what your house is made of these days. It's natural building techniques have become much more popular. it's not so much a problem of what your house is made of. It's the kind of lifestyle that you want and where you want to build it. If you want to grow your own food or keep some animals or have an orchard or, you know, practice woodland skills, charcoal burning or green woodworking or things like that, you need to be in the countryside. But the planning system isn't geared to allowing people to live in the countryside. You drive through the British countryside. I used to work in Romania before I started Low Impact, and it's startling how many people are in the Romanian countryside. It's a populated countryside by people who are working in the countryside. And Britain has been, the British countryside has been depopulated. And now the only people who live there really, they work in towns. Very few work in rural occupations. They either commute to towns or they're holiday homes or second homes or retirement homes. And that's one of the aims of the Ecological Land Co-op, is to try to help to repopulate the British countryside with people who actually work in rural trades, either smallholding or people who are helping smallholders.
Which is really good. I mean, if they are succeeding in doing that, because it seems to be quite clear to me that the fundamental aim of administrations in past years has been to depopulate the countryside, to move people into cities for whatever reason. And I've seen just exactly what you're talking about when I was working in Oxfordshire, sort of helping out in gardens and stuff. I just watched village after village after village die as the pubs and the post offices and the shops shut, because all of the people that were living there were, I mean, in that case, quite a lot of them were commuting to London and things like that. They weren't even going into Oxford, you know, they were travelling huge distances. And so the places were kind of dead during the day. I think it's great that people are out there trying to work at getting people back into the countryside, because, of course, it's also a matter of not losing permanently all of the skills that are our natural heritage.
That's another very important thing. A lot of these skills were, you know, they were to assist small farmers and smallholders, you know, whether it's sort of blacksmithing or basket making or all the traditional rural skills that needed to be incorporated in and around villages.
Which brings us to another aspect of what low impact might mean is when we start talking about the difference between sort of handmade local quality goods versus the kind of corporate tat that we're habitually buying. Now, I know that you're not going to get people in a kind of in these kind of communities building mobile phones and things like that, but loads of the other things we use, like you mentioned blacksmithing there. I've come across several blacksmiths in my time and used their services for having the most amazingly beautiful things made for gardens. Like archways that are decorated with like metal ivy leaves and things like that. And these people are incredibly reasonable when you look at the quality of what you're getting from a local artisan, as opposed to what you'd buy, say, at a garden centre. The results can be quite astonishing. And there's a lot of things we could be supplying locally, aren't there?
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned phones, but I mean, you know, there's the Fairphone now, which is a step away from corporate telephony, and who knows what could happen with 3D printing. But there's also the Phone Co-op. They can provide your phone services. Even things such as, and there's open source software, and you know, IT and communications could be moving away from the corporate sector. It is. You know, you can envisage it in the future.
Yeah.
But with the craft goods, I've had a very interesting conversation with people, usually urban people, and often people who I agree with are in all other respects. They're sort of they're politically minded. They lean towards a sort of anarchistic solution in the same way that I do. But they will say things like, "Oh, bloody artisan this and artisan that, artisan bread and craft beers and handmade goods. They're too expensive. How can ordinary people afford those things? They're very sort of bourgeois and middle class." And obviously I know what they're talking about, but I think they're coming from the wrong perspective. I mean, my brother says this all the time. "I can't afford organic food. How can I afford organic food?" And he lives on a council estate in the West Midlands. But he's got a giant flat screen TV. He's got a car. His missus has got a car. He's got the latest phone. You know, he wears designer clothes. And he's obviously, you know, he can afford those things, and yet he can't afford organic food. And for me, it's a question of priority. And I think actually we spend far too low a percentage of our income on food in this country. It's not seen as something that's as valuable as it should be seen. It's what keeps us alive. It's what keeps us healthy. It's what protects the environment if it's grown in a certain way. You go on, sorry.
And it is a choice what sort of technology you're going to run. I'm constantly amazed by how many people I see scuttling about the place running Mac computers, for example. You'll probably be pleased to know that this entire show goes out on open source software. And I was for a long time running really quite old laptops. This one's relatively new, but the software I use will run on much older machines, and it works, in my opinion, just as well as a Mac. In fact, to a certain extent, it makes a lot more sense to me. And we are choosing, you know, what kind of shoes we wear, what kind of car we choose to run, all that kind of stuff. Plus the fact that if you're actually engaged in this sort of activity yourself, I personally find that there's quite a lot of trading and bartering goes on, which means that we don't have to, by and large, spend as much on these what might be regarded as luxury goods as other people might. And I really enjoy using stuff that's been made by people that I know, or that I've got from a festival, from a handmade stall, or even something that's been rescued and repaired and sold again. You know, I think it's all totally brilliant. So much better.
This is what I'm saying. If we're serious about the kind of world that we want, we have to stop putting our money where our mouths are. And the argument that I heard, you know, people were saying, bloody hell, a £3.50 loaf. How can a loaf cost £3.50? And my argument is, if you want a £1.50 loaf of bread, then it's going to be a corporate loaf. And it's not going to be a very nutritious loaf. And it's going to be grown with pesticides, which is bad for the environment. And it's you have to pay a decent price so people can make a decent amount of money from it and have good ingredients.
I think the loaf that's twice as expensive can be twice as filling and twice as satisfying as well.
Yeah. And also, if people are able to start setting up small businesses like small breweries and small bakeries, which they are, that should be encouraged, because that's going to provide jobs and a lot more employment and a lot more income for working people than, you know, being a shelf stacker in a supermarket. The kind of corporate jobs that are on offer are either soul destroying or environmentally destroying, or they just don't pay very much. And, you know, artisan jobs can pay a little bit more to the people who do the work and cut out the middlemen.
It has been another movement that we've seen a lot over recent years, isn't it? Is the disappearance of real jobs. I mean, for a start off, where the United Kingdom PLC is making, if in as far as it is making any money, it's making it from invisible services in mortgages and finance and insurance and underwriting arms deals and all that sort of stuff. It's not actually making anything, and I can't see how those jobs can be that satisfying.
No. Yeah, like I say, I've talked to people, I've talked to bankers, and they're not satisfied with their work at all. I was talking to a guy at a party, and he turned out to be a banker, and so was his wife. I talked to both of them, and I told him about Redfield Community, and he said, "Oh God, I'd love to live there." And you could see the sort of despair in his voice. He just didn't like his job, and he said, "You know, I studied architecture at college at university, and I could easily build my own house, and I'd love to live like that. I don't like the world I've got myself into." But of course, his kids are at school. He's got a mortgage on a £2 million house, and he's trapped.
Yeah, because once you got it, it's extremely difficult to get out.
Very, very difficult. And
that's the thing, isn't it? He might be making a whole load of money doing what he's doing, but the thing is that people tend to spend a little bit more than the money they're making, no matter how much it is.
Yeah. But it was very interesting. His missus said, "So what do you do?" I said, I work for an environmental organization. She said, "Oh, we're going to fall out then, aren't we, if we start talking philosophically? And I said, well, I don't know, not necessarily. And she said, then go on, then persuade me. Persuade me of what your position is. So I said, okay, how can I get this across to you? I said, okay, so most people are okay, aren't they? Most people you come into contact with are, you know, reasonably kind, and they're not nasty people. Most people are okay. Most people want to leave the world a better place than they found it. Most people are not about to rip you off or be violent towards you. Most people are decent people. She said, yes, okay, I'll go with that. And I said, but my brother's motto is be nice, but remember, some people are, I won't use the word that he used on the radio, on your radio show.
Thank you very much. I don't want to have to donate to the swear box.
It began with C.
Yeah.
That's brother's motto. He said, be nice, but some people are something. And she said, yeah, okay, yeah, I work in the city. I know that there are people like that, yes. And I said, in this current system, these ruthless, selfish people, how do you think they would get on well in this system, or do you think this system works against them? She said, oh, no, of course, I work in the city. Ruthlessness and selfishness and greed will not harm your climb up the corporate hierarchy at all. And I said, well, that's it then. That's all I'm saying. If we have a system that allows bad people to get to the top of it, it's not a very good system, is it? And she said, okay, yeah, I agree. So it's just scratch the surface on people you think that wouldn't be natural allies, and actually they're not so far away.
No, when they think about it. And I guess one of the things about, you know, thinking about these individuals making their bread and making their houses and doing their small holding or whatever, and the number of people who quite possibly do actually, if they had the courage of their convictions, do probably have the resource, if they realised everything, to actually adopt this sort of lifestyle. We might start... Right. Sorry?
It's fear. It's fear of stepping into the unknown.
Mm.
But, yeah, this is why I want to build this network of people who will help them do it. Help them gain skills, help them to set up businesses, and it's, you know, it's a two-sided thing. If we need to invest in that world, we need to buy things that are produced close to home from natural materials, and we need to think about where we put our money, and then we'll end up producing a different kind of economy with much better jobs for the younger generation.
I think that's another really important point, is where we put our money, how we choose to spend it, because that, again, is a small individual decision that across thousands or millions of people, hopefully, would make a huge difference.
Mm. But it's not. It will make a huge difference. I mean, that's what low impact is all about, so I can't speak out against that for sure. It's a great thing to do. But not enough people will do it to make a significant difference. We still need to look up and start talking about what a new system might look like.
Mm. And
incremental change won't do it for three main reasons. It's too slow. We need to act really quickly. Not enough people will do it. And the corporate sector will see it coming, and they will either buy it. I mean, do you remember Green and Blacks and Ben and Jerry's and the Body Shop?
Absolutely right. All bought up.
Those kind of businesses were going to be a whole new way of doing business. And now Green and Blacks is owned by Cadbury's.
And Cadbury's is owned by Kraft.
Is it?
Yeah, afraid so.
The Body Shop is owned by L'Oreal, and Ben and Jerry's is owned by Unilever.
And do you think these... I mean, I've often wondered about that. I mean, do you think these companies were forced to sell, or did they just fall?
I don't know the details of it, but I don't know the details of it. They were obviously offered. They were obviously made an offer they couldn't refuse, and I don't know whether they couldn't refuse it because it was too lucrative, or because there were darker reasons. I don't know. I don't know.
Because it is the way it goes. It's not only that, is it? It's Skype and YouTube and all these things that. Actually, if they stayed in modest and competent hands, they could be generating cash for investing into other similar projects, and we could end up seeing, instead of the few corporations that we're heading towards, we could end up seeing millions of small enterprises cooperating with each other and co-funding each other, which would all be a lot more fun, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's Well, I thought that was the beauty of the cooperative sector. The cooperative sector couldn't be taken over by the corporate sector, and yet, they've recently swallowed the corporate bank whole. Mm. So it's not 100% secure from corporate takeover.
No, it's interesting, isn't it? I think it's quarter past 11 already, so I think we should have ourselves another music break. And then perhaps come back with some chat about the kind of changes that we think do need to be made. Would that be possible?
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Brilliant. And Nick Nomics put, if the unspoken word was the word I think it was, I object. The folks given that label are not useful or capable of giving pleasure. Which is fair enough. And I've actually got a tune lined up with that very word in it. I have it. So,
get away.
Yeah. So it's all right, though, because she's an artiste, you see, and nobody's going to chase her for a fight into the chat box. So we'll take another 7 or 8 minute break, folks. We'll be back after that. And this one's Geraldine Quinn and No One Cares. And as I say, if you're easily offended, you might want to turn your ears away from the radio during the chorus for this one. There we go, that was Jefferson Airplane and Stop Children, What's That Sound? Take a little look what's going down. That's definitely what needs to be done. People need to look around and actually see what's happening. So yeah, listening to Dr. Rock's radio show tonight, chatting live with Dave Darby from lowimpact.org. Welcome back, Dave.
Thank you.
And so in the sort of last 20 minutes or so, or 20, 25 minutes of chat, what sort of, with all of your experience and all the people that you've met and the things that you've seen, what do you think are the most effective things we can be doing to make the changes we want to see?
Well, obviously, all the kind of things that are on the Low Impact website, you can change your own life, you can move your money to help people who are doing things to change the system, and we can, you know, continue to incrementally change. But I fundamentally believe that incremental change will not reach that tipping point because not enough people will do it. There are lots of very, very good things we can be doing, but most people won't be doing it. You only have to look at the most popular newspapers, the most popular TV programs. You have to see how full shopping centers are on a weekend. It's just not enough people want freedom from this system. They don't understand the need for it, and the will isn't there. So I do think it needs systemic change, and the mainstream will just take the route of least resistance, really. If the system changes, they'll adapt to it. But I think we do, the people who do understand that we need a new system need to start talking to each other and work out what that new system might be and how to get there. Implementation is the most important thing, really. Can I tell you about my visit to Tanzania?
Yeah, go for it. What were they doing there?
My visit to the Ujamaa system in Tanzania. I travelled for about 6 years in my 30s, and I visited, it must be 100 different communities in about 25 different countries. I cycled from London to Jerusalem and back when I was 32. Took 6 months, and I stayed in about 20 different communities on the way and on the way back. But I also visited communities in Africa and India and Japan and Australia and New Zealand and various other places. By far the most interesting system of communities I came across was in Tanzania. And I'd read a book before in my 20s called Ujamaa, UJAMAA. And it was written by Julius Nyerere. And it was an idea of how African societies could be collectivized and escape from, you know, the colonial and the corporate yoke. And I thought this book was fantastic. And I wanted to go and see his system, you know, for myself in the flesh in Tanzania. And I did. I went to Kenya and I made my way down the coast to Dar es Salaam. I spent a couple of weeks in Dar es Salaam trying to get myself invited or taken to an Ujamaa village. I was shunted from department to department, and they just didn't know what to do with me. After 2 weeks, a jeep turned up at my guest house, t- told me to chuck my bag in and he was going to take me to an Ujamaa village. So I checked out and I spent the next several weeks in two Ujamaa villages. Now, Julius Nyerere collectivized the whole of Tanzania starting in the 1960s. In the early 70s, 20 million people out of a total population in Tanzania of 24 million lived in these Ujamaa villages. So it was an enormous system. It was possibly the biggest collectivization project ever.
That's a hell of a thing. That's a hell of a thing to have pulled off.
It's a hell of a thing to have pulled off. Now, so what I found out when I got there was a group of people waiting to meet me, one of whom spoke English. So I went to live with him in his hut. And each evening, people would come round, and we would have political discussions, which would be translated for me by this guy. And so the way that the Ujamaa system works is that each village has about 3,000 people. Now, each group of 10 villages, each group of 10 households elects one of their members to sit on the village committee. Now, the village committee will elect one of their leaders to sit on the district committee. And each district committee will elect one of their members to sit on the regional committee. And the regional committees will elect one of their members to sit on the national government. And that's how the entire country was run. No political parties. You were just electing a person that you knew personally from face-to-face contact. You knew them. You knew, you could judge them based on their intelligence and their compassion and their integrity. And that's how the political system in the entire country ran in the early 70s, which I found absolutely mind-boggling. So there were no wasteful, political parties and political campaigns. It was, you were just chosen because people knew you and trusted you.
And there's a novel idea, eh?
It was just a fantastic idea.
Yeah.
What happened was, well, the government provided a clinic and a primary school for every village. Villagers worked on their own plots. 2 days a week, they worked on the village plots to grow crops for cash, and the cash was used to buy things that benefited everybody, like a truck or a grain mill or something that the whole village would benefit from.
And presumably, that was decided by the village committee, was it?
Committee who were elected from each group of 10 families.
Yeah.
So all the food that they ate was produced on the village. They built their own homes from locally grown timber and mud and thatch. And there were no locks on any of the doors, no insurance required, no mortgages, extremely healthy, mostly outdoor kind of lifestyle. And I played football with them. I hung out with them. It was fantastic. In the 70s, the infant mortality rate and the literacy rate were the same as Western Europe, absolutely unheard of in Africa ever before. Basically, what happened to the Ujamaa system was that the World Bank cut off any sources of loans. They did not like that system for obvious reasons.
No private central bank.
Your listeners will know that the World Bank is not a neutral organization. It is completely corporate initiated and corporate controlled. And so obviously they didn't want Tanzanians to live independently and freely. They wanted them to be potential future workers in sweatshops and plantations. And they wanted them to be potential future consumers of Coca-Cola and corporate food and drink.
And they wanted to use their land for turning out coffee and pineapples for export into the West.
Of course they do. Of course they do. So they couldn't allow this system to be successful. So they said, no, that's not a democratic system. You need multi-party elections.
Pah.
Explained that it's more democratic than the Western system because you're electing people that you know from face-to-face contact, and we don't need to waste money on political campaigns. They said, no, you're not getting any more loans until you have multi-party elections. And of course they needed the loans to, so that they could have dollar currency, so they could buy oil, because you can't buy oil in any currency except dollars. So they needed loans from the World Bank to be able to buy oil. So they would have been in deep trouble. So they had multi-party elections, and the Ujamaa party, the Chama Chama Pinduzi party, who organized the Ujamaa system, they won with a landslide. That wasn't enough for the World Bank. They said, no, you're still not getting any loans until you dismantle that system. So they had to dismantle the system. Julius Nyerere brought the different tribes together on the villages. They said, you have to integrate and get to know each other, because there could be a potential for tribal violence in this part of Africa. And of course, he was right. It was Rwanda. And and he put Muslims and Christians together in the communities as well. And they intermarried. And but as I say, it was defeated by the World Bank. But this, I was there in 1990, and it was before the era of the internet, really. I mean, the internet existed, but not like it does now. And I just thought that this idea of people choosing their representatives based on face-to-face contact and judging them on their intelligence, compassion, and integrity, based on the fact that you know them and you've probably known them a long time, is just a fantastic idea. And I think that in the age of the internet, it could take off globally. And if it did take off globally and not just in one country, then the World Bank couldn't defeat it. You've still got the problem that, I mean, you could build a parallel system based on that. And that's actually what I intend to do. I intend to write a book and start a website called Ujamaa 2. It may not be everybody's cup of tea, but I think it's worth a shot, and I think it could grab people's imagination. And
I think any kind of democratic system that actually elects competent, known people is going to work better than what we've got at the moment, where we basically get given the people that we can vote for, and then there's every chance that your vote's not going to be counted anyway.
Yeah. And of course, their bank accounts could be completely transparent, so that we could see that they're not getting any backhanders from corporations. Mm-hmm. And definitely no corporate jobs. And it's a system that can escape corporate control, I think, and I think it's worth a look.
I think that's another important point, is the open book thing. That one of the things that we're really suffering from at the moment is that everything we need to know is being kept secret. You know, we're not going to get to find out about the TTIP negotiations for 30 years. All this kind of stuff. And all the cameras are pointed the wrong way. You know, we're not the public servants. They're the public servants. We should have cameras in police stations. We should have cameras in the Houses of Parliament. The people who are elected or whatever, who come by whatever means to represent us, should be completely in the public domain, and we should be able to see what's going on. I think that'd make a lot of difference as well. I think that's a great idea.
Well, we don't have any means of implementing that. We don't have the power to do it. So this Ujamaa system, people said, oh, so then what? So you build this parallel system. It doesn't have any power. And then certainly for anarchist type thinkers, it starts to get into fuzzier ground, because what you'd need to do is you'd need to put up candidates in your country, just standing on an Ujamaa platform. So their manifesto would state that they wouldn't actually take up their seat in Parliament. All they would do is, if they managed to win enough votes and to win an election, they would hand over power to the new system. I mean, it's madly optimistic, but I just think something like that is worth a try, and I'm certainly gonna give it a go. This is the reason I was talking earlier about this philosophy club that we've been having in each other's homes in London. It was just an attempt to see if actually people would enjoy coming together in each other's homes to get to know each other. And I mean, we haven't got to the point where we're thinking about electing one of our group to represent, I don't know, the south of England or something. We haven't got to that point. But it is a system that could, instead of just being the political system for one country, could actually constitute a new political system for the entire world. And it's a long shot. It's a massively long shot, but people do like meeting in each other's homes and having a drink and having some food and having a chat. And so if our experience is anything to go by, it wouldn't be a chore people actually enjoy coming together and having a chat and getting to know each other.
I think they do. Yes, indeed. We've started having some fire circles locally where we're doing just that, getting sort of 18 or 20 people together, and it's working really well. And I think a lot's going to come from it too.
What do you do at the fire circles?
Everybody brings some food, and we've only had a couple of them so far. So far we've just chatted. But I think that, you know, there's a couple there who want to who've just got themselves a home with an acre of land and an old railway shed, a massive railway shed with a ticket office and all that kind of stuff. And they kind of want to create a community hub. There's another couple who use their home regularly for all sorts of meetings to help people learn how to use their computers and things like that. There's another lady who's got land. It's taken her a bit of time to kind of get it together, but she's managed to get hold of a sort of rundown barn off the farmer, and she's hoping to set up a place where walkers can come, and she'd like to run what she calls a kind of a hippie hotel and a bit of a cafe. So they really do want to try and arrange it so that more people can meet and chat and get things done. And I just have a feeling that it could turn into something really great.
That sounds fantastic. I'd love to come along to one of those.
Yeah. Well, we've had a couple of them so far, and they've really gone well, and the food's been great. And I think they're kind of happening once a month. I don't know what we're going to do in the winter. But they're still kind of finding their feet, but the people that are coming along are actually, basically, I think the motivating people behind it are actually members of the local transition group.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of the people that are coming are not necessarily transition people, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
We've got a question in the chat box from GP.
Go
for it.
No, I was just going to say, if anybody wants to find out more details about the Ujamaa system I've been talking about, if you go to lowimpact.org and you put Ujamaa in the search box, that's UJAMAA, Ujamaa. And then if you search on that, there are two articles. One's quite a detailed article, and there's lots more information about the Ujamaa system.
The question in the chat box was... sorry, I'm just putting that in the search box myself. Did you hear of Michael Tanninger and his Ubuntu system?
Yes, I've heard of that. You have to remind me though. I don't know what it is.
It's a while since I've heard. I know that he's been on PIR with Sean Maguire, but I don't know enough in any detail to be able to remind you about it. So,
but I'm going to look it up.
Yeah. Here we go. I've got the. There we go. Yeah, I can see those articles now. I'll read those. How did Julius Nyerere go down with the rest of the world's politicians and stuff? Was he a popular leader, or was he somebody who got undermined?
He was a very respected leader. I mean, another thing that threw a spanner in the works of the Ujamaa system was he was the only African leader who would stand up against Idi Amin. And Tanzania actually went to war with Uganda, and it cost them quite a large proportion of their gross national product. He was a very respected leader, and he was spotless. There was never any dirt on him at all. He actually retired as president and went back to live on his Ujamaa village.
Yeah, sensible move. I mean, that in itself is quite a thing to have pulled off, isn't it? To actually be the leader of a country, do all that sort of stuff, and stay uncorrupted by the power and responsibility that you've got. That's also got to be something approaching unique, I would have thought.
There was one bizarre thing about him. I've never quite worked out why he did this, but for quite a large part of his life, he had a Hitler moustache. If you look up old photographs of Julius Nyerere, he's sometimes got a Hitler moustache. What's going on there? I thought that particular moustache was put out of fashion possibly forever.
Well, maybe he knew some stuff about Hitler that is not commonly known, eh? Another thing I'd just like to chat with you about, because it was something that I wasn't aware of, is the UN report that's kind of quoted on your website, which says that small-scale organic farming is the only way to feed the world.
Isn't that fantastic, the UN?
That's completely amazing. It's the last thing I'd expect them to see. Yeah. See them saying even if they did believe it to be true. It's really quite surprising that.
If you put small is bountiful into Google, you'll get quite an old George Monbiot article, and he's quite good with the old research, and he's looked into it in detail, and he puts forward very clear evidence that the per acre yield from a small holding, from organic small holding, is massively more than large scale monoculture agriculture. And yet the corporate sector would have us believe that the only way to feed the world is by huge monoculture GM farming. And it's exactly the opposite is true.
Well, again, I think it's down to the clever use of statistics, isn't it? Because they're constantly using their methods of actually measuring and reporting output and yield and stuff depend on monoculture, partly because it's so difficult to count the kind of the vast variety of stuff that can come out of an acre if you're using mutually supporting crops and things like that.
Absolutely. But I mean, if you do chuck loads of pesticides and fertilizer and irrigation at and GM technology, I mean, you can increase yields quite significantly, but the ratio of energy that you get out to the energy that you put in falls dramatically, and it's also quite an expensive way of producing food, and so it shuts out the small farmers from the food system there.
Yes, well, it costs money, and it's environmentally costly producing the fertilizers and things. Plus the fact that I think that you can chuck as much fertilizer as you like at ground, and over time it is going to stop producing. Whereas using small scale organic techniques and no pesticides and things, you're going to end up with a much more supportable, sustainable, and long lived eco structure.
Yeah, monoculture is really damaging soils globally.
Oh, here we go. Mr. Jimmy Fiction's asking, Doctor, is your guest aware of the recent reports coming out of the disaster on the way due to soil erosion?
We're actually mining soil in the West. We've lost an enormous amount of soil. I haven't got the figures at my fingertips, but we've lost an enormous amount of soil over the last 100 years in the West. And it's not obvious until you know, you're basically bare rock and subsoil, and it won't produce any food anymore. But we're heading in that direction.
My God, how often do we have to learn that bloody lesson?
Yeah.
You know, we've seen that happen in so many places for so many reasons, and we really do know that it happens, and we really do know how to prevent it as well, and yet the lesson, like so many others, just doesn't seem to have been learnt.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, I still think that your website is basically a beacon of hopefulness and correct direction. I still think it's really great to see those people getting together and writing about, albeit small projects, they are projects that are definitely forward moving compared with the way everything else is going. And I'd just like to say, 10 out of 10 to you for all of the effort you've put in over the last 15 years or whatever. And I hope you get your committee of people together to kind of to carry it forwards.
Thank you very much. We'll continue to build it as a bank of information and a directory of great people. And we'll just keep plugging away and we'll keep building it.
Well, that'd be really good. And I'll continue to read it, and I'll try and make contact with some of the key people on it and see if they'll come and chat to me on the show. And I'm sure that as time goes by, I'll find more stuff to talk to you about as well. So perhaps you'd consider coming back on at some point too.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, we've got sort of 10 minutes or so of the show to go, so I'll probably play out with some tunes. But I'd really like to say thank you very much to Dave Darby for being on with me for the 9 till midnight shift. It's a bit of a marathon. It's been really great chatting with you, Dave, so thanks once again for that. And I look forward to a continued relationship, hopefully. It's been a real eye-opener for me. It's been one of the best things I've seen for a long time, so thank you very much.
It's been a great pleasure, Ben. Thank you very, very much. And say hello to everybody down your neck of the woods for me.
I'll certainly do that. Of course, in a couple of weeks' time, we've got the WWF annual general meeting happening here, so there'll be a chance.
You have, yeah?
Yeah, chance to meet some of the people in person and have a chat with them as well. So I'll just stick on the Georgia satellites and working in the slaughterhouse, because whether you like it or not, folks, that's what's actually going on. Well, that's about it for another week, it would appear. Thanks to all of you for being out there. Thanks for all of the generous comments in the chat box and for your usual participation. Thanks to PIR, of course, for being here and for letting me be here too. No thanks to Ning, who don't seem to be doing a particularly good job at the moment, despite having Laurie's boots stuck up their arse, and I think Vin's having a good go at them as well, but I'm sure everything will be fine in the long run. In the meantime, 3 minutes of Motorhead leading you up to Martin Farrell, and it's a good night from me with You Can't Boogie with the Boogeyman. Cheerio, folks.